Hello, everybody, and welcome again to Nerd of the Third Power, your one-stop shop for all things nerdy and awesome. I am your host and master of ceremonies, Dr. Gonzo. With me, as always, in this epic quest of awesomeness is our resident anime goddess, the Cat. Cat, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Not too bad.
All right. And also with us is Skyblaze. How are you doing this week?
Not bad. Currently hoping that my house doesn't wash away, because it seems to be monsoon season in Sheffield at the moment.
I would take that over the snow.
That's fair. So I would take rain over snow as well.
Meanwhile, I have neither rain nor snow, it's just fucking cold.
I would just have rain nor snow nor glum of knit. Cat gets that joke.
Okay, and joining us this week is our new regular face on the show, our new correspondent. You know him, he's been on the show many times, he's a friend of the show, Mike the Birdman Dodd. How are you doing?
Well, reports of my assimilation have been greatly exaggerated, and I'm pleased to be here.
Yes. Brian is taking a bit of a sabbatical. Things are kind of really busy in his neck of the woods right now, so like I said, he's kind of taking a break for a bit. We wish him the best. And so in the meantime, Mike has been kind enough to fill in and add his considerable presence to the show.
Yes, I shall bomb you with info bombs. It'll be delicious and occasionally sexy.
So we got a fun show for you guys tonight. Tonight we are discussing something that I'm certainly really excited about. We've covered crossovers on the show before, but over the last couple of months we've had a couple of properties have releases that are major crossovers that have really passionate fan bases, and we're going to examine those properties. Those are Kingdom Hearts and Super Smash Brothers. So we're going to take a look at those two and try and figure out what it is about these properties that have inspired such large and passionate fan bases. So, but of course, there is procedure to follow, so we are going to begin first off with a major news story that has broken out in our semi-recurring segment, News of the World. And Kat, I think you've got something that you're itching to talk about.
Okay, yeah, but only because it just happened. As you may or may not know, I am a huge fan of Critical Role, which is, if you don't know what that is, it's an online web series and podcast where a bunch of nerdy-ass voice actors get together and play Dungeons & Dragons. And these voice actors are some of the biggest in the business. So it's like people from Overwatch and Last of Us and stuff like that. Just big, big names. And they've been doing this Critical Role show for quite a long time now. And they decided that they would launch a Kickstarter to get to see if people would be willing to shell out some money for them to make an animated special from their first campaign. And so they set the goal pretty high at $750,000. And they had the whole thing funded in about 40 minutes.
Good God.
And then it kept going. And within 24 hours, they were sitting at, what was it? $3.3 million that they had raised.
Wow, that's higher than the last figure I heard, which was like, last I heard it was hovering somewhere around $2
million. Yeah, I think when I went to bed last... No, it must be at like 4 now.
It's 4 point something, I think.
It's still going?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, with 44 days to go.
Yeah, well, only 44 more days. all expectations were blown out of the water because their stretch goals ended at $3 million, and they had it by like the time I left work yesterday. It's absolutely insane. I think they probably hit 3.8.
So entire series, then.
Yeah, so their crowdfunding stretch goals were like, if we make it to this, we can add 22 more minutes. And after this, we can add another 22 minutes. So at this rate, they have enough money to make like a feature length film if they really wanted to, or like a couple of shorter, like 22 minute episodes. And the studio that's going to do it for them is Studio Titmouse, who did, among other things, what's the show on Netflix?
Metalocalypse.
And Metalocalypse.
And Moral Oral was another big one. They're real big on Adult Swim. I think like half of Adult Swim's input is Studio Titmouse. So no, they do really good work.
Yeah, and
I'd like to point out they're at 6.1 million as of right now, and it keeps going
up. Oh my god, it's so crazy. The last I had looked was like this morning, and it was like 4.3 or something like that. My friends and I were taking bets on what they were going to end each day at. So they've well exceeded what they were expecting, you know, with 3 million being this insane stretch goal, and then they made it in the first 10 hours.
I remember just before this started, somebody on Twitter who is a fan, it wasn't UK, it was another friend of mine who's in the UK, was saying, like, posted up an image of their stretch goals and said, so what are they going to do for the second hour? And a laughing face. And I was like, well.
Okay, so obviously it's still really early in the project if they're just launching a Kickstarter within the last, what, 48 hours? But I want to ask, do they have any kind of ETA on like final release for the special?
They don't know when exactly, because they made so much more money, it's going to take longer time production to get everything out. But the backer rewards are set for next May. So I'm already dying because they made all this extra stuff.
You mean, if
they
May 2019 or May 2020?
2020.
Okay.
Ouch.
Yeah.
But that's fair.
Yeah, I mean, so they've got a lot of work to do because a lot of the backer rewards were actually really good. And because they've had over 30,000 backers, that's a lot of work they've got to do. I think I did the math yesterday when it was still around like 3.5 million and like 26,000 backers. And that meant like the average donation was like $135. But like they have, it, you know, like, oh, if you want to donate $25,000, here's what we'll do for you. So like the range was anywhere from $20,000 to $25,000. I donated $100. I was donor number, backer number 1970. So I got in nice and early before it got too crazy. And I'm really pleased with the rewards that they offered and everything. I think this is going to be really amazing. And it's a real good testament to not just the popularity of Critical Role, but of Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah, this is a landmark moment in the hobby. Like, this is, the hobby has never been hotter. It's never been more accessible than it ever has been in previous years. I mean, the most previously successful Kickstarter for a movie was Veronica Mars, I want to say. And yes, that took a couple of weeks to get to its goal. This just beat up Veronica Mars and took its lunch money.
And actually, Veronica Mars was number two, and the most successful Kickstarter for a movie or TV show was actually Mystery Science Theater 3000 reboot.
Oh, wow.
Read somewhere online yesterday. So they've got a little ways to go because I think the marker that they have to beat is $6 million, but they're going to beat it. Look at how much money they have made. And obviously it's slowing down compared to what it was yesterday, but it's not slowing down by that much.
In this conversation, they've raised over $3,000.
Yeah, like, it's ridiculous.
I'm just going to leave it up during the entire show just to see what it gets to. I'm curious.
Well, this is certainly a landmark moment in Dungeons & Dragons history, and we will actually be discussing that in detail when we do our actual Dungeons & Dragons episode later this season. Spoilers. So, so that's definitely going to be fun. But putting our focus back on this episode, that's a definitely huge story, and we'll definitely have more on that as it develops. And with that, we're going to move right into to my favorite segment and your favorite segment, the Ask a Geek. And we have got a big, huge-ass mailbag here. This is what happens when we go on hiatus for 2 months while I fucking move. All right, so let's dig into the mailbag here. First couple questions here come from Tyler, who is a frequent offender on the show, and he's got a question for me. And he asks, what would you say is your favorite system to collect for and or play? Not counting the Retron 5 and its attachments, so I don't get to cheat. I would have to say if I had to pick my absolute favorite system to collect for, I'd probably have to say Super Nintendo, just because there's so many games on there that I can't imagine not being able to ever play again. There's maybe a bit of a bias there because was the first console that I had that was actually mine. And so it's one that I grew up with and So there's a, you know, bit of bias there. And then we were also talking before the show, me, Skyblaze, and Mike, about how the Switch has actually gotten to be one of the larger collections in my library. I think I've got a little under 40 games for it now. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that this is the first time I've gotten in on a console on the ground floor, as it were. I think I got my Switch like 2 months after release day, just stumbled across one by accident. And it's been really fun following new releases as they come out and being able to actually get in on the ground floor on a lot of these games. And let's see, he's got another question here. This one's for you, Skyblaze. And he asks, what do you think are the best Sonic games?
The best Sonic games.
Yeah.
My absolute favorite Sonic game, it's actually one of my favorite games ever, it's in my top five, is Sonic 3 and Knuckles with Locked On.
Respect.
Good choice.
Yeah, quite cheerfully play that for hours and hours and hours. I really enjoyed Sonic Generations. I thought that was absolutely brilliant. I have a lot of very fond memories of Sonic Adventure 1 and 2. And you can pry my Dreamcast copy of Sonic Adventure 2 signed by Crush 40, Yuji Naka, and Takashi Iizuka from my cold, dead hands.
I am going to probably catch a lot of hell from this when I say this, but I do not like the Sonic Adventure games.
That's because you're wrong.
I don't know. Like, 3D Sonic has never clicked for me. Like, I remember loving Sonic Generations. But then I went back and played it again, and I realized that the things I really loved about it were the 2D Sonic levels. So
I like nearly all of it. The only sections I had problems with was Crisis City, and that has more to do with the fact that it's from 06 than anything else.
Okay.
The thing is about the Sonic games is even a lot of the really terrible ones have still got a really nice soundtrack. I just mentioned Sonic 06. It's a terrible game, awesome soundtrack. What's up with that?
Well, I mean, developers and musicians not working side by side, I guess. All right. And let's see here now. Here is one. It's addressed to Kat, but I'm going to open it up to all three of you because I know all three of you are Dungeons & Dragons players. And the question is what is the wildest set of dice that you own or have seen? So, Kat, why don't you start?
Ooh, okay. I don't know.
Because I know that you're just drowning in dice.
I do. I have a shit ton of dice. Most of them came from my brother and my dad who don't D&D anymore. And they let me raid their shit. And then I've bought a lot of my own sets. I don't own anything that's really wild. Like, I don't have any cool metal ones or made out of meteors or anything. Some ones that I have seen, though, have been, like, Mammoth Tusk.
Oh, wow.
Exceedingly expensive. I will, like, it was on some, like, luxury dice site that specializes in, like, specialty woods and stones and metals and animal parts. So it's
Are they sold to you by a man in a fine suit named Jeeves?
No, they're definitely sold to you in a guy in a trench coat in a back alley.
What are you buying? Dice.
Like, I hear luxury dice, and I imagine, like, walking into like, you know, a lounge with, like, you know, red velour carpeting, and everybody talking all, like, you know, like aristocrats, you know, oh, this is my diamond encrusted D20.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
actually get semi precious stone dice.
Yes, the weirdest by far. And maybe I'm remembering this wrong, but because it was like maybe half a year ago on Etsy. I swear I'm not crazy. I must have seen this. I saw a dice set on Etsy that were made of human bone and found in the home of a serial killer.
I'm pretty sure that the person selling that is themselves a serial killer, and you just bought evidence of a murder.
I did buy them, but I was
good
like...
Good choice!
Wow.
I want to play Call of Cthulhu with them. I'm just curious.
Right? Like, you've got to play something really, really, like, deep into some sort of death and mythos and stuff. And play
Birdman, Dark Souls D&D, get on it.
I could run that.
Do it.
That's just like any of the early D&D modules, isn't it? The meat grinder ones.
pretty much like the Tomb of Horrors or something similar, or Undermountain. For me, I actually own some specialty dice. A couple of years ago, artisandice.com sent me a specialty pair of dice that were made out of this smoked Texan mahogany wood. The dice are worth like $130-140. Jeez. They're really nice, really hard to read, but nice. They come in this magnetic wooden box, which is pretty sweet, but they're not... Those are my convention dice. I bring those out when I need to show off, or I'm showing off a game or something like that. My best dice I have are the 2017 Hascon My Little Pony dice. Signed by Stan Bush, of all people.
Oh, Stan Bush.
So those are my dice I pretty much play with all the time. I also have the Tomb of Horrors dice from Wizards of the Coast. I have a Power Ranger Halloween bucket just filled with complete sets of dice. I think like 30 sets because you never know when you're going to need a bunch of D10s or whatever. My wife just called me a nerd. And
you're literally on a show called Nerd to the Third Power. You are in good company, sir.
I've got a set of Call of Cthulhu dice, though I don't know where they are at this current time, which really sucks because they were really, really pretty. I've got sets for Vampire the Masquerade, Battletech, Mech Warrior. I have Clan dice, specifically for Clan Ghost Bear, though I don't know where they are. I've got Fallout dice, Ghostbusters dice for the Ghostbusters role-playing game from all the way back in the day. I'm trying to think of what else I have that's kind of weird. I think that's what I have in terms of weird dice. That's what I've got. The weirdest individual die I've ever seen is a D100, and it might as well have been a fucking tennis ball, because all it did was roll off the table, and you could never tell what it rolled anyway. So, that dice sucks. But I want the mammoth tusk, because I found out where they are. They're on artisandice.com, but I can't find out where they are on the site. Actually, fuck that. I'll go back to Google. You will be mine, unless you're retarded expensive. Oh my god, they're $2,000!
Yeah, and they're not in stock, because, you know,
rarely. Mammoth tusk.
Just, it's not like there's random mammoths wandering around.
Blair, can I buy these?
No.
And that is going to be our stinger. Skyblaze.
No!
Skyblaze, what about you?
The ones I commonly... The most unusual ones that I commonly use are cylindrical dice, sometimes referred to as glyph dice. I'll put a picture of them in the chat for you to actually see. There we go. So click on the link and you will see the dice. But they're irritate some of my GMs because... if you don't have a completely flat surface, they tend to just wander off. Particularly the D20s. I had a friend who had a set of stainless steel dice. They put dents in tables. They were terrifying.
I think I remember you telling us about that.
Yeah. But yeah, the actual stainless Sheffield steel.
The good stuff.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
The only other dice I can think of, the weirdest dice I've ever seen was for, I think it was for one of the expansions for the Doctor Who game, and they were a set of translucent TARDIS blue dice, but the numbers were in Gallifreyan.
Oh, that's cool.
Okay.
They were ridiculously expensive, but I wanted them so badly.
All right. Okay. I'm gonna go ahead and close this out because we're kind of running long on this. But the weirdest dice I've ever seen. I hesitate to call it a dice. Let me provide some context. I got a buddy of mine who he works for a blacksmithing shop, I guess, firm, whatever. He makes replica weaponry for like medieval times or Ren fairs, that kind of thing. And this guy is, I swear to God, he makes all this crazy shit. I swear he's going to be on an FBI watch list one day for some of the shit he pulls. And for a D&D game that his group was running, it was based around ninjas. He made a ninja star that he etched numbers into on each of the points for 1 to 10, and instead of rolling it, he would throw it on a dartboard on his wall, and whichever point embedded itself in the dartboard, that was his roll.
I want this guy to play with me. This guy sounds awesome.
Like I swear to God, like it was the wildest thing I've ever seen. And like, you know, he tells me about this. I'm just like, I'm imagining him like taking somebody's ear off with this fucking thing, just rolling for initiative. But like he says it drives his wife nuts, because every time that they played this game, she would just hear this thunk 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 of this ninja star hitting the dartboard.
I think I know this guy's like British twin.
But anyway, so those are all the Ask Geek questions that we have time for this week. Thank you as always for sending them in. As always, you can send them to us through the email at drgonzo@nerdofthethirdpower.com, or you can drop them on our Facebook. We have a permanent Ask a Geek thread that we occasionally trawl through and pull questions from. So yeah, get those questions in and you may get them read on the air. And with that, now that we've had our vegetables, it's time for us to get to the meat of this episode. And it's one that our topic this week is one that I'm really excited about. And as I mentioned at the start of the show, we've talked about crossovers in general on the show, but we've never really stopped to examine specific ones. And we've had two game franchises released in the last 2 months that they all hinge around crossovers, and they both inspired really huge, really passionate fan bases. And I really want to take these things apart and try and examine why. And those two properties are Kingdom Hearts and Super Smash Brothers. So we're just going to go ahead and just open up the floor. So Skyblaze, I want to start with you, because you're the big Kingdom Hearts fan in the room. What is it that drew you to Kingdom Hearts in the first place?
Well, first of all, I'm a pretty big fan of RPGs in general, particularly JRPGs, and I quite like Disney because it's kind of one of my pick-me-up things when I feel terrible. So JRPG plus Disney equals win, as far as I was concerned. And it looked great, and when I picked up the first game, it's like, actually, this is really fun. And then I started falling down the rabbit hole for now. Of getting into the story. And then I played Kingdom Hearts 2, and then I was doomed.
Okay.
Because I started to really actually like these people and care about what happened to them.
Alrighty. And one of the original the things that about Kingdom Hearts that I find really interesting is Kat has stated many times on the show that she is not herself a huge gamer, and yet she has also been snared by the Kingdom Hearts hook. So, Kat, what drew you to Kingdom Hearts?
Oh, well, my roommate sat down one day and was like, you're going to watch me play this entire game. So I didn't really have a choice, first off. It was not an option. It was just something that was going to happen. But that's what happened. I'm not like the world's biggest Kingdom Hearts fan, but I do really enjoy the story of it. I don't care that much about Final Fantasy, but I do enjoy seeing these very serious Final Fantasy characters and get mixed in with ridiculous Disney characters. I do like revisiting old Disney franchises. But yeah, like I love the characters in Kingdom Hearts, particularly Axel. I think is a really
Axel,
ugh. Because it's basically an anime. It's an anime, and all you do is you just fight stuff on occasion. And so there's a lot of like anime tropes in there, anime stereotyped characters in there. Yeah, Riku in particular, Riku and Sora are 100% anime stereotypes. So they're really fun to watch. It's really fun to see them change throughout the different games. I have sat through every game that can be played on a console. And I've seen clips and everything from every game that hasn't been played on a console. So I've seen like most of everything but the mobile game. And so you get really invested quite easily in where the story is going to go. Even though a lot of the elements of the game are very repetitive from game to game, there's a big picture. And it's only taken, like, what, 15 years to get to it?
about that. Yeah, I've been, Christ, I think I just graduated high school when Kingdom Hearts 2 had come out.
Yeah, so from beginning of Kingdom Hearts 1 till now, it's been a long time. So that's they have a lot to live up to in 3, which I have only seen a few levels of so far. So I don't know how it ends and if there's actually any payoff for the, you know, 13-year wait that between games. But
there is.
It's really, like, they have used the supplemental games to really build up more of a universe. And I thought, you know, as annoying as that is, it's a very clever way to make sure that when you go into Kingdom Hearts 3, that you know a lot, but you don't have to know everything. But that there's a really interesting story there that's just waiting for you.
Okay, and Birdman, are you which camp are you in? Kingdom Hearts or Smash?
Oh, total Smash camp. I came in the Smash from the competitive fighting scene. I had just graduated from playing Super Street Fighter 4 at my local gaming center, and they sat me down with a GameCube controller one day. Like, oh, hey, Mike, you might like this. Give it a try. And I decided to play with the most annoying character I could in Super Smash Bros. Brawl, which was Pit. And I used to annoy the fuck out of every competitive fighter in there, because we had people who were really good, people who'd come from Montreal to come play in the tournaments we had like once or twice a month. And I used to main Samus, I used to main Pit, and I would occasionally play Mario. And we would just have these incredible Friday night tournaments, these entire weekend tournaments that would run right from Friday until Sunday. And it would get super intense. And this was when streaming was just beginning to start. We'd stream it on Justin TV, so before Twitch. So way back when. And it was so much fun getting into that scene, getting into the competitive scene. Actually, before we did the show today, I decided to review the tier list, which I'm sure is controversial in and of itself, because Piranha Plant isn't ranked yet. That's how I got into it. Kingdom Hearts, I've always been interested, but never enough to check it out. I find the cosplay scene for that community really, really cool. There's actually a group here in Canada. They run something called Kingdom Hearts the Musical, which is really like a staple of the con convention scene in Southern Ontario.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, so shout out to those guys. You guys are awesome. I don't know what the hell's going on, but... And I see Keyblades at every convention everywhere. And I don't know. I always thought the idea of Donald and Goofy fighting alongside Cloud kind of awesome, but I haven't pulled the trigger on it yet. Though Kingdom Hearts 3 has me interested.
All right. Well, I'm a fan of the main Kingdom Hearts games, which tells you how long it's been since I've played one. last one I played all the way through was 2, all the way back on the PlayStation 2. But I am huge into Smash, and ever since it first appeared on the Nintendo 64, and it's been incredible to me to watch the journey from this game that just releases kind of almost like just a little thing they threw on as filler in the N64, you know, kind of who would win in a fight, Mario or Link, and have it evolve into this huge property that like people go absolutely nuts for. And this kind of leads into something that the next segment of this discussion. And that's, you know, the fact that these fan bases for both these properties, I mean, anytime there's a new Kingdom Hearts or Smash announcement, the fan bases go nuts. Like, I remember, like, when we did our E3 show last year, seeing people just flipping out at the new worlds that are introduced in Kingdom Hearts, like, you know, Monsters, Inc. or Frozen. And then people absolutely, there are whole YouTube video compilations of people just going nuts at finding out that, you know, a character that they've really wanted to be in Smash is announced, or like, you know, the big one that comes to my mind is we got like the night before Ultimate was released when Joker from Persona 5 was going to be in Smash Brothers Ultimate. And I guess kind of what like, the question I want to ask is, do you think that inclusion in these prop of, you know, these different characters and worlds in these properties adds sort of a bit of a prestige to them? Do you think there's maybe kind of a, you know, almost like a feeling of being inducted into a Hall of Fame when a Disney World is included in Kingdom Hearts or a character is included in Smash Brothers?
I think so, because it raises the profile of that particular property. It sort of cements it as it's new, it's hip, it's in. I don't know. I'm still hoping for Kingdom Hearts to take on Tron. I don't think they have yet.
They have. It's in 2.
Oh, shit, then, son, I'm playing you, that later.
If you have a look in my in the chat, that's the Kingdom Hearts Keyblade. I have a copy of it.
Oh, that is sick. I was wondering what that was. I'm used to just the traditional Keyblade, but
Yep.
I was about to say, like, having those particular properties and characters involved in Smash really raises, like, the profile. Like, I was surprised to see a Persona character in Smash. I'm like, Joker? That's kind of cool. That's got my attention. And that opens up the possibilities. But say, well, if he can be in it, well, who's next? And I am totally in the troll camp of I want Goku. It will never happen.
Oh, God.
But I think it'd be so much fun. The fact that we got Ryu and Ken, why the hell not?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, but then again, you look at all the different properties. People were even saying the Doom guy could show up. Hell, the Dragonborn from Skyrim could show up in theory.
One of the things that I've kind of noticed, especially with the last couple of releases, is how fan bases of different Nintendo properties kind of get bolstered as these characters have been announced. Like a good example is the Animal Crossing fandom, which the Animal Crossing series hasn't seen a new release in a number of years. But you know, when they announced that Isabelle was going to be a playable character, they also caboose that with an announcement of a new Animal Crossing game. So it's almost like Nintendo was saying, look, you know, we know that you guys are here and we haven't forgotten about you, you know, and we've got some good stuff coming down the pipe for you. So I think one of the reasons that so many people are drawn to Smash is it's almost kind of a love letter from Nintendo to their various fandoms. And I want to kind of see, you know, do you, you know, Cat and Skyblaze, is Kingdom Hearts kind of have a similar relationship with its fandom?
There's a lot. Since Kingdom Hearts became a thing, the Disney fandom has become a lot more involved in video game fandom, I think. It's kind of dragged in that section. And certainly a lot of the Disney fans have been, like, speculating about what if X new Disney film was put into Kingdom Hearts, redrawing characters as if they were appearing in Kingdom Hearts, redrawing like the Disney princesses if they were Keyblade users, which I thought was there was a massive Tumblr post which was doing all of the Disney princesses as though they had their own Keyblades, which was absolutely brilliant. Also, what you were saying before about it raising the profile of things. Some of the games, actually, they were relatively obscure. I mean, things like the Three Musketeers Disney thing, which was in Dream Drop Distance, or Hunchback of Notre Dame, which wasn't a huge success, and yet appeared in Dream Drop Distance as well.
It's also a little different because the production schedule has been so long for some of these games. So what they're doing now is something that, you know, like Frozen. Frozen was popular a few years ago, and it's not as popular anymore. So they can't work with whatever the latest thing is because of the length of time for production. But, you know, they also repeat a lot of worlds and stuff. So they keep going back to a Hercules world, but now we get to see it in a better high definition, and they'll go back to the 100-acre wood. And so they'll repeat some stuff for convenience sake. So we're not always getting like the most new thing, but it is always entertaining. Whatever they pick is always a good choice.
Okay. Now, something that I wanted to kind of ask, relating specifically to Kingdom Hearts. I think I mentioned this on the show, but a couple years ago, you know, my sister paid to take, you know, our whole family down to Disney World. I kind of mentioned on the show after that trip that, you know, you go to Disney World and it's one of those things where you know in your head that it's all smoke and mirrors. Mickey's just a person in a suit. It's just an actress on the float playing Cinderella. But for some reason, like, you believe it, you buy into it. And you know, there's that's like the Disney magic. Like, even though you know it's all an illusion, you buy into it and you believe it's real. Do you think Kingdom Hearts has kind of a similar quality to it in that it allows you to interact with and explore these various Disney worlds? And that's a large part of the draw to the franchise?
There's a certain innocence is the wrong word, but it's the closest I can think of right now, considering it's midnight. There's a certain innocence to the Disney world, and a certain, again, naivete is the wrong word, but that sort of
purity.
Yes, purity and joy of childhood to the Disney worlds and to the properties that Disney creates, even when things are scary or difficult or, you know, horrifying, there's still that kind of purity to it. Kingdom Hearts gives you the opportunity to kind of immerse yourself in that and, like, not be an adult for a bit and instead look at the world through in a different way.
It gives you this whimsical eyes of a child, this sense
whimsical.
Of wonderment, right?
Whimsical, that's the word. That's one of the words I was trying to get to. Thank you. Thank you, Mike.
There's definitely a lot of nostalgia that goes into it, especially with the older properties, when you're looking back at, like, the 100 Acre Wood or Hercules, or one of the big ones throughout the games has been the Nightmare Before Christmas. And that's God, we nerds love Nightmare Before Christmas. Mm. So it's like fan food. You're just feasting on getting to play in these worlds and getting to revisit these characters and seeing slightly different interactions. Like, one of the first worlds you go to in Kingdom Hearts 3 is what's the name of the kingdom with Rapunzel? Corona or something like that?
I think so, yeah.
And some of it is, like, scene for scene out of the movie, but then there's, like, new stuff and you're like, I think I have this all figured out. And then you hear new bits of dialogue and you're like, oh damn, they made changes to this character and it's so perfect. They gave this character new dialogue and it's exactly what that character would say. So it's almost like, in some cases, you're getting an extension of something that you already know and love. And then some ways you're looking at it from a new perspective. But either way, you're like, you're just eating up this new content for something that probably won't get new content.
But you were saying about nostalgia. One of the biggest nostalgia pops I had was actually playing Dream Drop Distance when you go into what's referred to as the Symphony of Sorcery, which is the Fantasia level.
Oh, and, my God.
Yeah, and everything's done where, like, all the jumping noises and hitting the enemies is done with, like, orchestra stings instead of the regular sound effects. And I was, like, squeeing for, like, 3 days over that. Because it was just like, ah!
Now
this
I wanna,
is like being in Fantasia.
Now, I want to leap off that fan food, because with Smash Brothers, it's almost like a total opposite kind of thing, where whereas with Kingdom Hearts, it gives you kind of the worlds to explore and to look around in. Smash Brothers, because it doesn't really have a story to speak of that unifies it all the games, the fandom has kind of just made up their own. And Skyblaze is going to get a laugh at this, at what I'm about to say next, because it's something that I swore in a previous show I would never do. But Smash has got me reading fanfic.
Aha! One of us.
And it's really neat to see how so many people in the fandom have come to similar conclusions of how these different characters would interact with each other. Like, one of the fanfics that I'm reading is one called One Year. And it's set in the Smash Brothers Brawl era, and it's about Solid Snake and his first, you know, year in the Super Smash Brothers tournament, And there's a scene that I really like where he meets Lucas from the Mother series. And anyone who's played Mother 3 will tell you, Lucas gets the absolute shit kicked out of him throughout the entire game. Like this kid gets like just the worst hand dealt to him possible. And here you have this battle-scarred war veteran who has been through, you know, a whole bunch of shit, you know, meeting this kid, and they become like, you know, they become friends. Snake becomes almost kind of like a father figure to Lucas during his stay in the Smash compound. And it's really interesting to see like how the fandom will react to and play around with some of these concepts. Like there's a bit in the fanfic that I was not prepared for because it brought the feels. But it dealt with the first time Snake has a match on the Shadow Moses Island stage, which is a stage from the Metal Gear series. And the prop Metal Gear breaks through the background. And when Snake sees it, he goes into a full-on PTSD episode and flips out. And it was, you know, something that like, you know, wow, you know, this is heavy, but it's something that like, you know, yeah, I never thought of. But, you know, you would think that seeing this thing that has been such a hellbringer in his life, yeah, that would kind of mess Snake up, I think. And it's really cool to see how fandom comes up with different stories and interactions surrounding these characters. So, and I know that the fandom for Kingdom Hearts is equally passionate, has come up with some equally cool stuff. So what's some neat stuff that you've seen come out of the Kingdom Hearts fandom?
Ooh, where to start? Even before Kingdom Hearts Number Days came out, there was a lot of speculation about the relationship between Axel and Roxas and depths of their friendship, whether it be brotherly, whether it be a romantic relationship, whatever it was. A lot of it was accurate once Days came out, and it was very much along the same set of lines of that development.
Can I say I find it funny that as huge a Kingdom Hearts fan as you are, even you aren't going to fuck around with that weird ass title.
I can't. I've got dyscalculia. I can't remember numbers, so they just like it just becomes like hash in my brain.
I don't know any two people who can agree on how that fucking thing is supposed to be said.
Are we talking about 358 divided by 2?
Yeah.
It's supposed to be over, not divided by, apparently.
Oh, I just do whatever my roommate says.
It just goes days to me.
Numbers.
numbers, business.
numbers, business.
Is this working? I am in fact Unikitty, it is true.
But putting the train back on the tracks.
there was a lot of speculation on that. One of the best things I saw was somebody doing a speculative fic about how Kingdom Hearts would treat the Princess and the Frog and Dr. Facilier and his friends on the other side actually being either the Heartless or the Organization.
Ah, oh, they should do
and
that.
And I was like, that was awesome! And they didn't. I'm really disappointed that they didn't do it, possibly because the movie wasn't quite successful enough, and that makes me very, very sad.
Okay, Birdman, what about you? What's something cool you've seen come out of the Smash or Kingdom Hearts fandoms?
I love the tournament scene. My God, do I love the tournament scene. Although I don't like tournament players, but I like the scene. the fact that it's growing, that we had Melee and Brawl at Evo, now it's Super Smash Bros. Ultimate now, and there's legitimately huge prize pools for this. Nintendo supporting it. It's just neat to see the amount of videos on YouTube where people are like, hey, here's a combo for Mario, here's a combo for Mega Man. In fact, I was looking at this kid's tier list, which has something like a million views on YouTube, and my character, my new main, Mega Man, is in the upper mid tier, which, you know what, good enough for me. My first main, Samus, is in garbage tier. So I'm not going to use her anymore, which really sucks. But no, just seeing the strategies that come out, like here's how to edge guard. Here's how to use your neutral air to do a kill confirm, stuff like that. Just seeing all the different strategies and techniques that come out of these players. And some of the stuff is stuff you wouldn't even think of. I used to play against a girl who played this wicked Peach. My God, you couldn't touch her for the longest time. And it wasn't until I sat down and started studying YouTube videos, I started figuring out, okay, I can counter her this way and this way. She has to react like this, so I can knock her off the stage and do it this way. So for me, the biggest cool thing that comes out of the Smash community for me is strategy and their willingness to put that knowledge online to teach others so people can get into the scene. Now, admittedly, when you go to a tournament, you're going to come across a lot of pricks. It's just the way it is. Any fighting game community is full of it, but there are some really nice guys out there who will teach you. Plus, one of the best people to come out of, I want to say, I'm pretty sure he's a Smash player. I think his name is Sonic Fox. He shows up at tournaments in a furry outfit. That guy's awesome. And he plays like a lot of competitive fighting games, and I'm pretty sure he's a Smash player. So, but yeah, just you genuinely see a lot of really good thinking come out of it, and that's what I got to praise them for.
Okay. Kat, what about you? What's the coolest thing you've seen come out of the Kingdom Hearts fandom?
Well, I'm actually going to steal Skyblaze's answer from earlier, is the fan art. Because I don't really care that much about a lot of the game aspects or anything like that. But I love just looking at the artwork that people create, like Skyblaze was saying about, like, crossovers and speculations that end up in the artwork. What would all the Disney princesses look like as Keyblade wielders and stuff like that? Just the sheer amount of time and energy that people have had. Like, there was a really big gap between games where people had nothing better to do than to just, like, keep the fandom going through art and through cosplay and stuff like that. And the artwork.
And draw Axel shirtless.
Yes, of course. I mean, that's what this has all been leading up to, really.
Yep.
But whereas I think like the cosplay has died down, but the artwork always remains because it's so accessible online. So obviously that's just a constant. There's just always tons of it. And you can follow some random page on Facebook that's a Ventus fan page and you'll just get an onslaught of art every day. And it never stops. And so I feel like that's just been a large part of keeping the community alive over such a long break, is just people's shared interest, not just the story continuing, but like through the artwork.
All right. Well, we're kind of running down the clock here, so let's start wrapping things up, giving our final thoughts, and kind of summarize what it is we think about these properties that we think has inspired such passionate fan bases. So, Skyblaze, why don't we start with you on this one?
For Kingdom Hearts, there's such a sprawling story, and there's so many interesting new characters that have been introduced. I mean, all of the people who are part of the Organization 13, current, ex, otherwise, the new characters, I mean, Sora, Kairi, Riku, interesting in and of themselves. The way that the various Disney characters have been displayed, it will never stop being funny to me that one of the biggest badasses in the Kingdom Hearts universe is Mickey fucking Mouse. He gets, like, that ultimate, like, badass moment in Kingdom Hearts 2 where he rips off the coat after he thinks Goofy's died and is like, does the badass charge thing, and you're like, this is Mickey Mouse. And yet, this is awesome. What even is this? It's so insane, and yet it's so great.
Okay, Kat?
Okay, Kingdom Hearts has a lot of pretty boys. We're just going to get that out of the way because that's true. It's a large part of the fandom is that there's just tons. They don't run out of pretty boys. And then the Fujoshi out there are just like, oh, what if this pretty boy kissed that pretty boy? So that's a large part of it. But it really is this, like Skype was saying, it's absolutely insane when you think about, you know, putting these Disney characters into these scenarios, and and making it feel right, making Mickey Mouse feel like this badass, and creating these character interactions between Disney characters who would never meet, and making that feel natural is such a big part of it. The Disney fandom in general is a little on the cray-cray side. And the Final Fantasy fandom, it really, like, there's not as much Final Fantasy the further you get into it. But the style, the Final Fantasy style that has stuck around, the way that they try to blend all the different styles to this style is really interesting. It's all just, the whole thing is kind of pandering when you think about it. It's just like, hey, we're going to take this set of fans and this set of fans and merge them together and create these super fans who are brand new fans of a brand new thing. And
your powers combined, I am Captain Nerd.
Yep. And it's just worked out so well for them, and they have the money to do it. So, yeah.
Okay. Mike, what about you? What is it about these properties that you think has inspired such passionate fan bases?
Competition. The fact that Smash Brothers continues to introduce new characters and new strategies every patch. Like, the game changes every month when they nerf and they buff certain characters. So the meta has to constantly change, has to evolve. Each tournament result adds to the ongoing tier list, which gets updated by the community each month. And the fact that just so many good competitors can rise up from out of nowhere, dominate a tournament, and just really show off just how accessible this game is. Smash Brothers, to me, is a game that's easy to learn but difficult to master. I mean, I've been playing since Brawl. I wouldn't call myself good. I'd call myself competent. And I look forward to each match that I can play against friends. I look forward to humbling certain friends, stuff like that. And every time there's a Nintendo Direct, I can't wait for them to say, a new challenger approaches. And I just get so stupid hype for it. So for me, and what I think a lot of people get out of it, is we get new competition and new competitive scenes to fight in. To me, Smash is a gift to the fighting game community that keeps on giving.
Okay. Well, I'll wrap this up by saying that for me, Smash Brothers represents, like I said earlier, a love letter, not just to Nintendo fans, but to gaming fans in general, especially with the inclusion of so many third-party characters, like, you know, characters from Castlevania, Pac-Man, now we've got Persona, and to bring all these characters together and all the history behind them as well. It reads just like kind of just a love letter to gaming and its history. And it, in a way, that love sort of transcends the game itself, and similar in a way to, and it works the same way for Kingdom Hearts, I think, where it gives us a chance to, you know, one of the things that we want as geeks is to be able to interact with these worlds and these characters that we love so much. And both Smash Brothers and Kingdom Hearts give us a chance to interact with these worlds and these characters and these stories that we've grown up loving, and actually kind of be a part of them in a way. And I think that that is really sort of the essence of fandom. And I think that's that ultimately, to me, I think that's what these two properties represent, is a crystallization of fandom and our love for these worlds. So anyway, that's all the time we have for Third Power this week. Before we go, though, just out of sheer morbid curiosity, Birdman, what is the Critical Role Kickstarter up to right now?
$6,148,988.
God damn.
Wait, is that in Canadian dollars?
No, yes, actually. So that's a lot more in U.S. money.
I was going to say, I think mine says $4,615,300 in U.S. dollars.
More impressive than Canadian.
Either way, it's more money than any of us will ever see in one sitting in our lifetime.
So, it's true.
So that's all the time that we have for Nerd of the Third Power this week. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. We will see you guys next week when we review Captain Marvel. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. We'll see you guys next week. As always, I'm Dr. Gonzo.
I'm the Cat.
I'm Skyblaze.
And I'm Mike the Birdman Dodd.
All right, we'll see you guys next week. Taka, play us out.
Blair, can I buy these?
No.
No.